Welcome to Huawei Conversations, Directions Media's interview series with geospatial insiders and outsiders. This is Adina Schutzberg, executive editor. In mid-March, Twitter rolled out the second part of its geolocation functionality. Now, in addition to being available via its API, users could share location information from the Twitter.com website. That's when the world learned that Twitter had tapped geodata company Maponix to provide the place information for those tweets. On March 24th, I spoke to Maponix CEO Darren Clement about the value of context in location-based services, how Maponix was working with Twitter, the state of geographic base maps, and the potential uses of real-time geodata. I'm joined today in the virtual hallway by Darren Clement, and he is the CEO of Maponix, a data company based in Vermont. Hi, Darren.
Hi, Adina. How are you?
Very good. I'm kind of lucky because you and I have been having this ongoing conversation about the state of data for the last, four or five years, off and on?
Yeah.
Maponix's name came up just recently because of Twitter's announcement about adding geolocation not only to the API, which is where it had been, but now to the actual Twitter homepage.
Yes, and we're obviously very excited about that. Working with Twitter and understanding the number of users that they have really, I think, plays to some of the strengths that we bring to the market, particularly that as they enabled geolocation on their platform, they realized that context was, in some cases, more important than just the lat long. And so what Twitter announced last week was that all the neighborhood context that they provide is being provided exclusively by Maponix.
Now, you and I can have a conversation about context in location. Do regular people know what that means, or do they just know what it means in terms of, oh, somebody says that they're at the airport, and I know what that means?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. We got to be careful of jargon, and we know what context means. Does the average user use the phrase context? No. But do they implicitly understand context? Absolutely. Like you said, you know, at the airport tends to be something that has concrete, defined boundaries.
Sure.
Whereas something like a neighborhood doesn't. You know, where does a neighborhood start and stop? That context users get a feel for. So if, you know, you're on your smartphone in a Starbucks, you know what neighborhood you're in. And a lot of geotagging and from there georeferencing of context historically has been more as the crow flies distance. Am I within a half a mile of something? I'm nearby the Empire State Building, and so is my friend. Therefore, let's meet at the Empire State Building. But what that doesn't get you is the context of, oh, I could go 1 mile to the north and be in neighborhood A, and a quarter mile to the west and be in neighborhood B. And so when you're thinking about social networking, as obviously Twitter is, that context, again, even though users don't use the phrase context, that context becomes really important to those average users because it determines where they're going to go. Are they willing to go to a neighborhood that is closer but not so desirable for some kind of a social event?
And this really leads into this whole question of how end users are using location. And that's really been sort of ramping up over the last couple of years as the tools on smartphones and even on laptops have changed. So it used to be that we know that you can key in an address and key in another address and you'll get a route between the two. And you also know that you can use some sort of reverse geocoding and say, what is the address at this point? But I think what people are beginning to understand is those pieces of information aren't that valuable unless you have a map. And sometimes even if you have a map, you don't have a sense of what that location is unless it has a name. So that's why getting a response of a name, you're using the Starbucks example a minute ago, and I just started hanging out at a local Starbucks, and every time I log in there, it says the address of the Starbucks. And to me, that's not, I mean, I know where I am because I walked there, but we've got several different neighborhoods in my city, and I'm at the Starbucks over on Spring Hill as opposed to the one in Davis Square. And I think that would have much more meaning for somebody if they wanted to find me than the address even.
I think you're hitting on a really important concept. I mean, the location, if you're the one sitting in Starbucks, you know where you are. So the location and the context isn't as important to you as it is to anybody else that you might want to know about you. And that's one of the things, you know, when you think about privacy issues and saying, well, do I want everybody to know my lat long? Do I want everybody to know my exact pinpoint location right now? Nah, I really don't. But do I want to broadcast to a broader world, meaning my friends, that I'm in this neighborhood? Yeah, I do. So that context that we talk about, whether it's neighborhood or zip code or any other kind of a regional context, solves many problems. It helps you broadcast where you are without the risks of giving up privacy.
So it really doesn't enhance privacy. I don't know that people think of it that way, but in fact it does, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people will come to. I mean, as an example, Twitter, and I don't want to speak for Twitter, but you have to turn on this feature. And when you turn it on, you can either broadcast your lat long or you can broadcast your place. I think what you're going to see over the next, I don't want to be too much of a prognosticator, but let's say 6 months, is an awareness from the average consumer that, oh, you mean I can either give out my exact location or I can give out my general place? I really want to just give out my general place because I get all the benefits. If I'm in West Side, that's good enough. All my friends will know I'm in West Side, and if they want to meet for lunch or whatever, they'll know that. They don't need to know that right now I'm at the library. They don't need to know that.
Now, when a user chooses to use Twitter's location feature, as you pointed out, they can either say, I want to share my exact lat long, or I want to provide a meaningful location, a context, but they don't actually have any say as to what information is put out as their context, because Twitter, indirectly through Maponics, is deciding what's getting sent out, right?
Yes, at the neighborhood level, all of their meaning Twitter's, contextual information and names come from Maponics. We don't provide the latitude and longitude, of course, but once Twitter has that lat long of the user and the user says, I want to broadcast my place, that place comes from Twitter doing the point and poly of what polygon, what neighborhood from Maponics does that point fall in.
Right. And that could be the airport?
Sure. I mean, it, you know, if the airport is in our database, then sure. It'll usually airports are kind of an unusual polygon.
Right, they're special, and I saw that in an example. That's why I keep coming back to it.
If you're in an airport, you can think of it as two footprints. There's the airport itself, which is the building.
Right.
And then there's the airport footprint, which includes the entire perimeter, all the airfields and everything like that. So if you think about airports as being an area, we don't usually think of them as neighborhoods, but we don't want to have a big gap in the middle of the city of our data, so we still have them in there in the quote-unquote neighborhood layer.
Okay, good. So in fact, you would... If I was at Logan Airport right now and said, locate me, it wouldn't just draw a blank. It would actually say something like Logan Airport.
Right, exactly.
Maybe you can't talk too much about this, but I'm guessing that Twitter did its homework and eventually found Maponics as the folks they wanted to use for this place information.
This wasn't like an overnight process. You're right that I can't go into too much detail, but we've been talking with them for many months. They've had to do lots of evaluation on our data. They can probably speak more freely about what that evaluation entailed, but they clearly came away feeling that our data was going to support their intentions, which their intentions are clear. They want to have context for those tweets, and neighborhood is just the beginning, and domestic is just the beginning. They're going to be using our data worldwide because our neighborhood data is expanding throughout the world. And the deal that we have with them allows them to use it throughout the world.
Have you gotten any feedback either from users or from Twitter about how it's going, how people are feeling about accuracy and usefulness of those places?
No, I mean, there's been some feedback on Twitter's geolocation platform itself, but as far as the neighborhood information that goes along with that, they just turned it on, I guess, about a week and a half ago. And so far, we haven't heard from Twitter that there's been sufficient feedback for it to be meaningful. I mean, they get feedback all the time, but they haven't put it together in a sense that draws any conclusions about, oh, you know, there's problems in Chicago, or gosh, everybody loves the Boston area. It doesn't come back to us in that format. But with all of our customers, we have an ongoing feedback loop that we use to incorporate and make our data better. It's just right now, it's still too new.
Is there a mechanism set up where you will, in fact, get some of that feedback through Twitter as to, you know, where people think, well, it said I was in the east side, but I really thought I was on the west side or whatever?
I don't mean to shirk the question. There's a mechanism, but I really can't talk more about it than to say that there is a mechanism.
Awesome. I'm not surprised that you can't talk about it, but that's great to know, because this is a really neat set of people to get feedback from.
Absolutely.
I mean, in addition to all the other ones that you guys already use to have built this data set in the first place, so that's pretty interesting. One of the things I wanted to talk to you a little bit about is how the data landscape has changed in the past 6 months, and if, for me, there was sort of a line drawn when we learned, interestingly, we were in the middle of our location intelligence conference, and we started hearing the rumor that all of a sudden on Google Maps, it didn't say copyright TeleAtlas anymore, it said copyright Google. And everybody's going, oh, what does that mean? What's going on? And we checked into it, and of course, Google has decided it's going to, in a sense, roll its own data set. That, of course, led to the navigation tools in Android, and that's free, and now there's free navigation on the Nokia phones, and everything's sort of rolling down some new and different path.
You definitely cannot sleep with Google on the scene, you know? That was breathtaking, to be honest. And while I'm sure a lot of people were hypothetically talking prior to the event that something like that could happen someday, some way, not only is it breathtaking what they accomplished, but also that they were able to keep it under wraps for so long, right up until they went live with it. It's pretty remarkable. It changed the data landscape for what I'll call base maps. The idea that Navtech and TeleAtlas, while I don't think they're disappearing by any stretch, it does kind of make you scratch your head and say, all right, what is the value in that land base of geographic data? It's something we at Maponix never really had any intentions or desire of getting into ourselves, but that was mostly because with the two giants out there, why would we get into that? And so we've always focused more on specialty data sets, but it's clear that somebody like Google can do almost anything they want. And data itself, while you could say data is still incredibly valuable, I mean, Don Cook used to always say that, and Don Cook's the founder of GDT, which was then bought by TeleAtlas, he used to always say that data is the gasoline in the car. And so everybody's always going to need gasoline. The one twist I'd put on that, though, is that gasoline is consumable. You buy a gallon of gas and it's gone. Data isn't quite that transient. Unless you're talking about mapping real-time data, which we're not in this conversation, the kind of land-based features and the stuff that Maponix also provides isn't consumed and burnt up, but it does still change. And if you have an organization like Google, where you can, through various methods, compile that foundation, you don't have to rebuild the entire foundation every month. And what Google has just done is they've taken, you know, 20 years that TeleAtlas and Navtech, maybe even longer, 25, 30 years, of Navtech and Telealis to develop their asset, and Google compressed that into what seems to be like 2 years or so that they were developing.
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that. And when you think about that scale, anybody in the data business has to be saying, where is our value add? It can't just be in brute force scale, because somebody like Google can always come around and trump it. And that's certainly not what Maponics is viewing our business as. We don't view it as, you know, our specialty is in scale. Our specialty is in know-how, which is why Google actually uses our data. But I'm sure at Telealis, they were saying the same thing.
One of the things I took away from that is that, wow, we never thought of nationwide U.S. land base as being a commodity. Google has sort of asserted that it is, and I'll make the statement that while what they've got up there now is pretty good, it really isn't as good and doesn't have the fine-tuning over the years that the Telealis and the Navtech data have, for sure. I mean, there's been all kinds of high and low profile kinds of issues with the Google Maps data. But what interests me now is, if that's sort of a commodity, what is the next hot value added data set? Oh, maybe neighborhood data. Is it possible, and this is, I'm sure if anything keeps you up nights, it would be this, that somebody's going to come around like Google did and do what they did to Telealis, in a sense, to Maponics and the few other folks who do neighborhood kind of data?
Certainly it's a fear. There's two ways to answer your question. One is on a technical sense, and one is on a business sense. So I'll answer the business way first. I mean, the business way is, any company that puts all their eggs in one basket has the fear that that basket can be blown up. And so we certainly don't rely on neighborhoods for all of our revenue. And like you were saying, even Telealis, they weren't relying on the land base itself for all their revenue. It's all the attribution on top of that. The accuracy that they bring to bear, as you mentioned, still gives them a leg up in certain markets. But on a technical sense, you're right that there can be disruptive technologies or disruptive players that come in and render something that Maponics does, or that any of our competitors does, as a commodity. And when that happens, the product lifecycle is cut short. And are there ways to hedge against that on a technical sense? Yeah. And I mean, I can tell you that we're already trying to essentially put ourselves out of business technically. We're already developing technology that could rebuild our neighborhood database using similar tools that somebody else might think of, so that essentially we want to do it first. I think that's a really important approach that anybody out there in the data business has to be doing, is saying, if somebody's going to disrupt us, shouldn't it be ourselves?
You want to kill your own cash cow, I think is how I heard it.
Exactly. What Google has done really highlights the fact that no player is safe in any industry. Because I think 5 years ago, somebody were to say to you that Google was going to be one of the dominant players in geographic data, people would have looked at it like, what? No, they're a search engine company. Yeah, they're going to make a lot of money off of ad revenue. Nobody really was talking about them being a dominant player in GIS. And I think it's just a few years before they're a dominant player in energy. So if I were sitting there on the energy front right now, I would absolutely be sitting there saying, what is Google going to do in the next few years that's going to put me out of business?
And I should make sure I do it first.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I was thinking, as you were talking about how you and your team are trying to put yourselves out of business, one of the big tools that we have now that we didn't have 5 years ago was this explosion of social media. And it seems to me, based on our conversations in the past, that an awful lot of what you do, especially in putting together something like the neighborhood data, is that's not the kind of thing that you can drive down the street and take pictures and draw the lines as to where the neighborhood boundaries are. It's much more of an analysis of people and how people think and how they divide things up. It's much more getting into their heads. Now that we have social media, we've got this new way to get into people's heads, even if it isn't necessarily by asking them, well, you're standing here, where do you think you are? You know, it's much more subtle. It could be picked up from something like a blog post or an update in Foursquare that says, oh, well, I just had some pizza at the Pizza Zone, you know, in Newington. And that's what they decided to call it, whether or not, you know, everybody else does or not. So I'm thinking that there's a lot of opportunity to take advantage of that information.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we focus on geographic areas, you know, so for the geeks out there, you know, polygons. And there are two different types of polygons. Actually, I'll call it three different types of polygons. There's formal administrative type boundaries that are regulated by either an industry or a government. Then there's informal boundaries, things like neighborhoods, which are more perceptual. You ask 100 people who live in Newington where Newington starts and stops, and you're going to get 5 to 10 different answers. But then there's a third, which I call real-time coagulations, and that's the idea that there are a group of people congregating for a concert in the park. The duration of that polygon is a few hours. It doesn't have much of a lifetime, whereas a neighborhood could have a lifetime of anywhere from several months before it changes to several years before it changes. And then administrative boundaries could be anywhere from annual update cycle up to every 10 years. When you think about the different types of polygons, the different types of areas, and the overarching life cycle of them, you've got to really be thinking about social networking, because social networking is a great source of information in reverse order, meaning the real-time coagulations rely almost exclusively on social networking to determine their boundaries.
For them to exist, in a sense. Yeah.
Exactly. You could even say, they don't exist without social networking. Although, in my example, I mean, they were having concerts in the park 30 years ago, but they didn't have any media definition, if you will, of those boundaries. You know, nobody could market to them in real time because people weren't carrying any kind of device. People couldn't socialize with each other through any kind of communication device.
They couldn't be documented in real time.
Yeah, that's a great way. That's a great way, you know, to define it. You're right. They couldn't be documented. And then even the informal boundaries, like neighborhoods, they're not real-time coagulations, but they are very much guided by perceptions. And the types of things you mentioned are absolutely ways that we're using to enhance our data and expand our data to reflect really the kind of the common consensus of where boundaries start and stop.
Now, what's the value of these real-time coagulations? I'm thinking, I mean, South by Southwest was just, you know, in the last 2 weeks or so, and everything that I read, having never been to this event, seemed to suggest that as soon as anybody got anywhere, especially the interactive part of this as opposed to the music and film part, they would check in. So that, in fact, there were these real-time groupings happening at hotels and bars and out in the street, who knows. How do you turn that into value? And is that something that somebody's going to do?
Well, if I knew how to turn it into value, I'd probably be starting a company focused on that part of it. But I do believe there is value there. I know because of who we're talking to. I know because of the tools we're developing. But how do I assign a value? I don't think anybody really knows yet. I think everybody believes there's value. I think end users absolutely believe there's value. In fact, if you ask them, I don't want to say your grandmother because she's probably not using smart devices, but let's say, well, I've got a college-age daughter. So if I ask her, out of those three levels of a polygon, if you will, which are most important to you? There's no contest. To her, the real-time coagulation is the most important. But how are people monetizing that? That is a little more elusive. because we certainly know that people in those real-time coagulations don't want to be inundated with dollar-off coupons for the closest Starbucks. I mean, that's not what it's about. That's not going to be any appreciable revenue source. But I think it's kind of tied to use context in a different frame or different definition. I think the contextual ads that could be on those platforms do start to imply a source of revenue. For example, you take some of these check-in sites, and there's an event going on, and they have a sense of let's say they have some retail marketers out there. They could start showing on the map the locations of their advertisers. So it's more subtle, kind of in the background. But if you're looking at the map, you're seeing all your friends are congregating over near some place, and you see this little icon for a Starbucks. It's not an ad, it's just an icon. Are you more apt to click on it? Yeah, probably. But right now I'm really out on a limb because this is not my business. You know, I'm not, as CEO of Maponics, sitting here generating revenue off of social networking platforms themselves. We very much rely on our customers like Twitter and others that we're working with to tell us what they need when it comes to geographic information. And they're not sharing with us, at least in any concrete terms, exactly what their revenue generation plans are.
Yeah, but it sure does sound compelling. As you're telling that story, especially thinking about a college-age kid's view of the importance of different levels of geography, yes, it is fundamentally different from what I want to know, or even from what, you know, my parents want to know about geography. And yeah, the time frame of the kinds of things that I'm interested in are much more, they're not going anywhere, right? But as we're talking, I was picturing sort of one of those traffic monitoring sites that I know the city of Boston has one, the state of Massachusetts has one, and a bunch of folks watching real-time traffic cams up on big monitors, and you can see what's going on all over the city, and some of their jobs is to open up lanes or change the timing of traffic lights, those kinds of things, to keep the traffic moving. Well, I can envision the same kind of picture of, let's take Central Park as a geography, and noting where there are clumps of people and what they're talking about. Are they watching a movie? Is there a guy playing the guitar? Are the kids playing soccer? And being able to capture not only the location, but what's going on, and then in real time somehow providing information to that group in some meaningful way.
Yeah. I love that. I hadn't heard that analogy before with the traffic flow systems that are already in place. I think that's a really good analogy that people could use to kind of start framing an answer to your question of, you know, how are people going to value this? Value meaning how do you translate all this information, all this documentation, if you will, of locations in real time, and turn that into something that users value and that businesses can make profit from? I love that analogy. So I'm certainly gonna chew that around myself, because I think it's a good translatable framework to use.
I like it too, and as I'm processing it, I'm thinking of when my nephew was about 4, he would go to play in the micro soccer league in Cambridge, and it's this little tiny field, and they break it up into even little tinier fields because these kids are so little, and there were probably 100 kids out there at a time with 200 parents on a Saturday morning. And boy, you know, if you're the ice cream truck guy, you want to know that.
Yeah.
If you're the public health person who's in charge of making sure all the kids get their H1N1 shots, you know, what a wonderful resource. Yeah. And you may
Beautiful,
or may not know about that. I mean, there's certainly one way to track that in the local paper, where are the events for families, kinds of things. But there's also this potential real-time. So here you go. The person sitting in that looking at all the big screens with all the information and can send out the tweet to all the, you know, ice cream trucks saying, hey, here are the hot spots for right now. Yeah. In an hour, I'll send you the next one.
Yeah. And then not only does that mechanism allow for kind of the real-time communication to the ice cream truck or whatever, but, you know, you mentioned that, you know, the alternative is looking up for events in the paper and planning ahead. The problem is you don't know how many people are going to show up. So there's going to be this event Sunday morning at 10 a.m., but three people might show up or 300 might. And if you're that ice cream truck guy, you don't want to go to the event if it's only three people. You know?
You almost need to have like a reserve. I'm only going to go if there's going to be 100 people there.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot here. And I'm sure, you know, that the social platforms that are trying to monetize, because a lot of them still aren't making much money at this point, I'm sure that they are going to, you know, listen to some of the things you're talking about. And if they aren't already considering them, they're going to add them to the mix, because I think these are really valid ways that you can do it without being intrusive. You know, with the concept of the ice cream guy, you know, you're not talking about broadcasting dollar off coupons to all 200 parents that are there. You're just talking about the guy who operates the ice cream truck saying, I'm going to get off the couch and hightail it over and just park my truck outside so when everybody comes out, they'll see me. It's not in your face kind of marketing. And I think that's going to be really important, that because consumers are going to, they're going to rebel if they just feel like all that's being done is being marketed to them.
But it sounds like no matter which way these things are going to play out, they're going to have to come back to people like Maponics to get not just that base map of where the streets are, as we pointed out, that's people have got that covered. But this next layer of context, be it neighborhood or maybe even sub-neighborhood, there's many different ways to use that term context, and I think you guys are pretty set for a while in staying ahead of the context curve. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. We're very confident that we're not going to be supplanted anytime soon.
Well, hey, Darren, I want to thank you for your conversation. We got a little bit off topic, but I think we both got some interesting things to think about.
Good conversations often go off topic, so...
That's the way I like it. Well, thank you so much for your time and best of luck with Maponics and your work with Twitter.
All right. You're welcome and thank you for having me.
You have been listening to a hallway conversation with Maponics CEO Darren Clement. If you have questions or comments about today's podcast, you can email us at editors@directionsmag.com or you can leave a comment at Directions Magazine or All Points Blog. Thanks for joining us and be sure to tell a friend.